Okay, we're reading from Luke 10, verse 25. Just then, an expert in the law stood up to test him, saying, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law?" he asked him. "How do you read it?" he answered. "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." "You've answered correctly," he told him. "Do this and you will live." But wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Jesus took up the question and said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him, beat him up, and fled, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the road. When he saw him, he passed by the other side. In the same way, a Levite, when he arrived at the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan on his journey came up to him, and when he saw the man, he had compassion. He went over to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper and said, 'Take care of him. When I come back, I'll reimburse you for whatever extra you spend.' Which of these 3 do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers?" "The one who showed mercy to him," he said. Then Jesus told him, "Go and do the same."
Right, there's a bit of poetry from Luke 10 as well. Let's quickly close our eyes before we start. Lord, we pray that you bless us this evening and open our hearts and help us to understand the richness of this particular passage. And Lord, we ask you to slow our hearts down and to focus our minds wherever it might be at this stage. To listen to you, whether we believe that there's somebody or something to listen to or not, that we'll have an openness about us as we approach you this evening. We pray this in your precious name, Lord. Amen. All right. Good evening, everyone. It's absolutely horrible to follow Yaku after his poetry session and his very entertaining announcement. So, as a matter of fact, when you guys fall asleep, I'm just going to call him up to just run through the announcements again, so we can do it. By the way, I was laughing primarily because you said being a Christian, we believe is about worship, and then I kind of imagined you saying, you didn't, being a Christian is all about grace, and then you started, being a Christian is also about works. And that's why you need to go to Tembisa so that you can earn salvation and all that, which is entirely correct, by the way. So,
yeah, we don't say that.
We don't say that. We said it in the announcements, but not in the sermons. So this is the sermon section. We try to censor it. So the Good Samaritan, or the Samaritan, is very, very famous in all of society, actually. So whether you're a Christian or not, most people identify or know about this story. So to illustrate this, if you go on a quick Google search, don't do it right now, you need to concentrate, but if you go on a quick Google search, you'll see that there's thousands of hospitals called the Good Samaritan, or the Good Samaritan Clinic, or the Samaritan Clinic, and primary schools and preschools, all named after the Good Samaritan. And as a matter of fact, whether people are Christian or not, they would often refer to somebody, "Oh, that guy is a good Samaritan," meaning that he's always trying to help, or she's always trying to help. So it's something that's in our consciousness, and so much so that people write poetry about it as well. And that's why we had Yaku read something about this person trying to put the Good Samaritan into a modern context. And it's a lot of fun when we play with those kind of ideas. Now, this whole conversation, if you listen carefully to when Lorraine read the passage, started off with a person asking, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" That's how this whole conversation started. Now, by the way, it's a little bit bad social skills to, this is the first thing you ask somebody. It's a pretty big question. It's up there with what's the meaning of life, what's the good life, what should I do with everything, or whatever. So if you just meet a person, before you introduce yourself and you say, what is the meaning of life, or how do I inherit eternal life, I think the first thing we need to do before we can have that conversation is to have a general conversation about social skills and asking that person about his name, talking about the weather. But this is how it all started. And then the play goes on, and Jesus, in a very typical Jesus fashion, asks him a question, all right? And that's one of the very annoying things with arguing, when you argue with Jesus, because he kind of responds with a question. And then after he's responded with a question, he'll tell you a story. So it's very, very annoying. That's why a lot of people, I think, walk away from Christianity unsatisfied, because they don't really like the methodology of the person that this whole Christian thing is based on. So the follow-up question is, how do you answer this? How do you answer this question? And he says, love God and love your neighbor. Love God and love your neighbor. And that was a common idea within Judaism. So if you look at the Ten Commandments, the first, I think, four commandments has to do with loving God. All right? How do you love God? And then the next section has to do with how do you love your neighbor? All right? So when they sum that up, they just say, love God and love your neighbor. So it's a very quick way. It's a summary of the law, of everything. If you love God and you love your neighbor, then everything will be fine. But here's something, and it might sound a little bit controversial. I think most worldviews would say that. Most worldviews would say that the answer to this big question is love God and love your neighbor. For instance, the Eastern worldview, I think, would agree with that. But here's the problem. The problem comes in with definition. How do you define God, and how do you define neighbor? All right? But I think they'll agree with that context. Last night I spoke to a guy, I think he's a bit of an Eastern mystic, and it's very tricky because you would agree on a bunch of stuff, but you realize that your definitions or your understanding of these terminologies means two very, very different things. So an Eastern person, what I mean by Eastern person, say a Buddhist or a Hindu, would define God as everything is God and God is in everything. It might be something like that. And if you hate your neighbor, you are practically hating yourself and you're actually hating God as well. And it sounds, and I'm not trying to mock it, I think it sounds quite beautiful. But that's why I think they'll agree with this. As a matter of fact, I think a materialist worldview, Marxism or something like that, will agree with this, depending on how they define God and how they define neighbor. We can get into that later. But here's the point. Jesus goes into these definitions, and he goes into these definitions by looking at a story. He looks at the definition of God, because I think this story tells us something about loving God, and I think this story tells us about loving your neighbor in a very subversive way. Now, if this was, let's consider the first audience that heard this. What would they have understood when they heard this story? The first thing is, a man was walking down from Jerusalem to Jericho. So he would have noticed this picture over here. Obviously, he would have noticed this picture over here. The road between Jerusalem and Jericho is quite hectic. So Jericho lies, I think, about 200 meters below sea level. Jerusalem lies, I'm guessing, but it's around 500 meters above sea level. And they are only about 20 to 30 minutes today by car away from each other. So it's a significant drop in a very short space of time. In other words, it's very mountainous. And it's very obvious. So if you say he was walking down, it's obvious that he's walking from Jerusalem to Jericho, all right? So Jericho, even today, is it's the oldest and lowest inhabited city in the world, which is, I suppose, the thing that you see when you drive into that town. Donkey Peter. So it's very low and it's very old, and this is how you descend towards Jericho. But because there's a lot of mountains, it's also easy for robbers to hijack you And they knew this. They knew this was a dangerous road. It was called the Bloody Road. And I think it was called the Bloody Road, not in how we understand the Bloody Road today, when we think it is a particular municipality that's not taking care of the roads. They said Bloody Road, and it had a very literal understanding of the term blood. Because the robbers could easily hide. So even today, when there's terrorist organizations, where do they go and hide? In the mountains. Because it's difficult to get them over there. So this was a notoriously dangerous road to travel on. So that's the first thing that I think a first century listener would have picked up. And then the fact that the guy was robbed and the description of it would also have not surprised the person. Because in those days, you didn't carry a lot of cash with you. You didn't carry a watch with you. So among the most valuable items that they stole was your clothes. That's pretty much what they went for. So yes, they took a bit of cash, but it was difficult to carry cash because it was massive coins. So you would have, developed a spine problem if you carried too much coins. So your clothes was part of your most valuable possessions. So they mug this guy, they take his clothes, they take everything. So again, I don't think anybody would have been surprised by this scenario that is sketched. And the priest walks by. That's the first thing we hear. Now, we can have a little bit of sympathy for the priest, because remember, a priest's duty is at the temple, and he needs to perform all these rituals and all these ceremonies, and if he becomes ceremonially unclean by touching a corpse, he's not allowed to do that. If he does it, and he touches a corpse, and he didn't tell anybody, then he's going to become a corpse. So you can excuse him, but there's only one problem. He's walking down. Why is that a problem? Okay. The temple is not down there. The temple is not in Jericho. So he already finished his temple duties. So he didn't have the excuse of being ceremonially unclean, because he was still allowed in his own house, even though he was ceremonially unclean. He was still allowed to say hello to his kids as a ceremonially unclean being. So he doesn't have the excuse that he's going to the temple, and he walks on by. Doesn't do anything. Now the priest in this story is the top of society. Even today, when we think of a priest, we've got a very high royal view of this person. A Levite is just underneath a priest. They were supposed to help the priests in their duties. So you can see this this sequence going down. You had a priest and you had a Levite. Levite also just walks on by. Now remember, it's a Jewish audience. This man that's mugged in the story is obviously Jewish. A priest walks by, he's Jewish. Levite walks by, definitely Jewish. Now the third person, who's this guy going to be? Now all of his audience would have been excited at this stage, because everybody likes a bit of a rebel who accuses the power that be and challenges the power that be. So even today, when people challenge government or challenge church structure, it's okay. They can be within the church and challenge church structure. So for a Jew, or for Jesus to say, and it was a common Jewish man, the layman, that went and helped that guy, they would have said, yes, I like this story. I like this story. It had the build-up. It was a layman that helped him. Yes, good. And they expect that, and the next moment, Jesus reveals a big Kansas City shuffle. And he said, a Samaritan walked by. Now, at that stage, you had a very worried audience, because this is not going the way that they thought it was going to go. I've told enough about Samaritans. Are you guys all clear on the fact that Samaritans were hated people back in the day, all right? So when you tell somebody he's a good Samaritan or he's a Samaritan, that is not necessarily a compliment, all right? It's only a compliment because of these passages that we have over here. So that is something that we need to acknowledge. So he brings in that, and he shocks this entire crowd at this very big reveal. Because a Samaritan, as you guys know, is a half-bred, compromising mongrel in the eyes of most of these Jews. So they were absolutely shocked at what happens here. But I've learned now in my preparation for this talk that Jewish storytelling worked in threes. All right? So here's something that you can impress somebody tonight with. It worked in threes. And actually today, our storytelling works in the same way. So if somebody says, so Jan van der Merwe, a Scotsman, and a... Yeah, walks in. We know that these stories works in three. When somebody wants to make a great sermon or a great a speech, you say there's three things we need to remember. It's amazing how we can reduce things to three. So we've got three people in this story. But there's also three things, three actions that the Samaritan does after that. The one is he attends to the wounds. He throws wine and oil on them, which was an ancient way of medical aid, I suppose. Then he transports the half-dead person on his horse to a nearby inn, and then he compensates for money with money for what happened. So this guy, when he wakes up, he's got a bit of cash, and these people are willing to take care of him. So there's three people that walks by, and there's three actions. And what most commentators say about this is that this Samaritan does all three of the things that the other people were supposed to do. The Levite was or the priest was supposed to help him with his wounds. The Levite was supposed to transport him, and he compensates for what the robbers took, what the thieves took. So we've got these three things happening in succession, and the Samaritan does everything. Now, Kenneth Bailey is a New Testament scholar, but he's based in the Middle East, so he's got some tremendous insights. And he says to put this in a modern sense, for us to make sense of this parable, it would look something like this. Imagine a red Indian, a Native American, walking by a cowboy. This cowboy has got three arrows in his back, all right? So what this Native American does is he tries to treat him, but the arrows are still in there. But he treats the wound somewhat. This guy is obviously still alive. He puts him on his horse, and he takes him to the city. But remember, the city is this western town, all right, where they've got the one street, they've got the wooden houses lined up next to them, and when somebody walks in, there's always somebody chewing something, spitting on the ground. And here's an Indian guy walking with a white, looks like a dead cowboy on his horse with three arrows sticking out of his back, all right? That is not a very good way of making an introduction to any society, all right? So people are going to be suspicious. He then walks into the saloon area where you've got those doors that works like that. And as he walks in, he puts this body with the three arrows on the table and he says, listen, here's some money. Please take care of this guy. I'm going to go back. I've got some stuff that I need to deal with. If you spend more on this cowboy with three arrows in him, then I'll compensate for that as well. Do you think that Indian would walk out of that town alive? No. So what the emphasis is, and it's the emphasis throughout the Gospel of Luke, is the cost of discipleship. If you want to follow Jesus, it's going to cost you a lot. And probably in this parable, it ends very open, but it might even cost you your life. And this is a massive point that this parable wants to illustrate. So back to the original question, who is my neighbor? Remember, that's what he asked. He said, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And then Jesus said, what do you think? He said, love God, love your neighbor. He said, okay, you answered correctly. And then the guy said, okay, but who's my neighbor? Who's my neighbor? Now back to that question, because Jesus answers this in a very subversive way. This guy knew the answer to his own question. He knew what he wanted to hear. He wanted to hear a law-abiding, pure Jew. He's my neighbor. A law-abiding pure Jew. If you read any of these loving your neighbor terminologies in antiquity, it had to do with your own group, okay? It didn't have to do with neighbors as we understand it today, where a Muslim might move in next to you, or Malema, or somebody that you consider to be an enemy. It was very clearly your own people. And this is what this guy knew, and this is what he asked. And Jesus subverts this question. You know why? Or you know how? Because you cannot identify this person. They cannot identify the victim. So you love the people that look like you and smells like you and talk like you. Those are the people in the in-group. But when Jesus tells this story, there's no way to determine whether this guy, this victim, is in the in-group or not. Why? Because he's naked, so you cannot judge him by his clothes. It's very easy to identify somebody by his clothes. If you go to Israel today, I can point to you very easily who's the Muslim and who's the Jew. It's very easy to make that identification. As a matter of fact, I can identify who's the Christian in a lot of circles. It's very easy to identify a Catholic Christian. It's very easy to identify certain African denominations. When you drive by and you look at an open piece of field, it's very easy to identify the various groups. So we still do that today. But this guy's naked. It's a little bit more difficult to identify his grouping. Another way to identify is through accent. So you guys can very easily identify, Johan is very much an Afrikaans speaker who obviously went to an Afrikaans university and only spoke English since June last year. We can identify somebody how they speak. And if you consider South Africa, it's very easy to identify the Zulu, the Khoza, even if they speak English. Just by their names, you identify them. Various names. And if we can take it back to an Afrikaans example, those of you who are in the Cape, we know that they say ik instead of ak, all right? That's pretty much the only word, and people want to be cute, so when they live their whole lives and study up here and they live in Cape Town for 2 months, they develop this accent miraculously, the magical ik. But that's how you identify people, by how they speak and how they dress. And yes, also by the color of their skin, but remember, it was a bunch of Arabs. They pretty much looked the same. So they were dependent on those two things. We've got a naked guy without clothes. That's what happens when you're naked. And we have a half-dead person who cannot really speak. And you cannot really judge his accent by his breath. So it's impossible to determine whether this guy, who this guy is, or to which clan he belongs. So Jesus mocks the system. Because this guy is actually asking, how can I identify my neighbor? How can I identify my neighbor? And Jesus is saying, that's a stupid question. That is such a stupid question. Because now, you probably have to go back to your law books and write a system how you identify a person that's in this situation when he is naked, because they didn't have licenses with them. They didn't have passports, so it wasn't easy to identify them in that way. So he's mocking how they judge who's your neighbor. Can you see that? By telling a parable where it's impossible to identify this particular person. And even by asking Jesus the question, who's my neighbor? Because it's very clear that the Bible says he was trying to challenge Jesus. He was trying to find him out. It's very clear that in that question, he's trying to determine whether Jesus is part of the group or not. That's what he's trying to do. And Jesus thinks that it is ridiculous to do this whole thing. He, for lack of a better word, he screws with this whole identification game. And what he's basically saying is just help. Just help the person. Forget about the identification. Just help this person. Because remember, this priest and this Levite, by Jewish law, would have been compelled to help him. They were supposed to help him. But they couldn't because it wasn't quite clear what person, what identity, what race, what ethnicity, tribe, religion this guy's from. And in the end, you've got this unlikely hero, the Samaritan, who does all the things that the priest and the Levite were supposed to do. And it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. And the end of the parable is actually hilarious, because Jesus turns the whole thing on his head. Because he says, let's just go to that last phrase again, Christine. He asks, which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell? Can you see how he changed the words in terms of neighbor? The first one was consumer language. In other words, who is my neighbor? This is action language. To whom am I a neighbor? Do you understand the distinction? The one is consumer, the one has to do with identifying my clan. The other one has to do with action, not with consuming, but with action. Who do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? Now, this is extra hilarious. Obviously, this guy by this stage is very annoyed with how this whole thing went. And he cannot even say this person by his name. It's like it's Voldemort. That's how bad it is to say Samaritan. So he says, the one who showed mercy. It was very clear. It is a priest, it is a Levite, and it's a Samaritan. This guy is so annoyed with this whole thing that he cannot even say his name. So he says, oh, the guy, the person, I suppose, or the third person, you know? Because he doesn't want to utter those words, because no way can this guy be the hero of the story. So he says, the one who showed compassion, I suppose. And I can just imagine he's looking in the sand and, but it's stupid, it's a stupid story, I don't care about it. I want to go, oh. I want to warn you that if you follow Jesus, if you really want to try and do this whole thing of following Jesus, the group that you call neighbor is going to grow exponentially. It's going to go a little bit out of control. And that's a warning that I think anybody who wants to commit himself to Jesus needs to know. And it kind of sucks as well. Because you cannot identify your grouping through economic standing. Because Jesus doesn't allow that. You cannot identify this grouping through religion. You cannot even identify, if you're a Christian, you cannot even identify with other Christians as your group. Because it's an organization that exists for its non-members. Doesn't that suck? You don't even have that group. Because you're supposed to look at the people who's not there. All right? You cannot identify them by politics. You cannot identify your neighbors by their skin color. And on top of that, if you really want to be a neighbor to all of these people, it's going to come at a tremendous cost. It's going to come at a tremendous cost. What did it cost the neighbor, the Samaritan? He had to change his plans, probably, because he had to go to in the next Jewish settlement where he went to take this guy. He lost wine. I know to a lot of Christians that sucks to know that if you follow Jesus, you're going to have to sometimes sacrifice your wine and your oil. He uses his car, his petrol money, to take this person to help him or her. And then it costs you your money because now you have to pay for this person who can't even thank you, who can't even make a sound, and it's not as if you get this immense gratification by doing this good deed, because all this guy is doing is he can just make sounds like the beginning of the Revenant movie. There's not really any interaction that you get. It's a little bit like raising a 1-month-old baby. It's just needy and no recognition. And ultimately, if we consider what Kenneth Bailey said about the context of the story, it might even cost you your life. You might, as a red Indian, not even walk out of this conversation or out of this situation alive. That's the game. But remember, I said in the beginning that the parable is twofold. Yes, it's about loving God. It's about loving your neighbor. And that's how everybody has always understood this. But there's also a massive element about loving God. So what is the God story in the parable of the Good Samaritan? You see, Christians have always said, and this is very interesting if you read the church fathers like Origen and Augustine, how they interpreted this text. Christians have always claimed, this is the Christian worldview, that we are broken as humanity. We are bruised and battered and naked. Because sin is attacking us in such a horrible way that there's no way to stand up from that with dignity. We are bruised and battered. That's the Christian idea of us. And to get out of this whole thing of being bruised and battered, you cannot fix it with religion. The priest just walked by, remember? You cannot fix it with the law. You cannot fix it with all your tricks to try and be justified with God. That's why it's very specific that the priest walked by. The law is not going to help you. You're going to stay in that road, half dead. Your clan is not going to help you. Your grouping, that there's going to be a saving agent that enters this whole thing on his own. And he's got no good reason to save you. And he stops there and he attends to your wounds. That's what the Christian story is about. This external agent attending to your wounds. And guys, you are all wounded. So as we are having this conversation, God is attending to our wounds. And he transports us. And here's the amazing thing. He puts money down. He kind of puts himself out there and says, listen, I will take care of this person. I'll take care of the payment. Whatever it costs, I'm standing in for this person. I'll come back and you can sue me for the money. You understand that analogy? When the Samaritan takes this person, he says, here's the money, and for any extra money, I'll stand in. Forget about this person. And this is the Christian story, this external agent restores us. Restores us from being mugged by sin. Now, here's the million-dollar question. All this time, we are unconscious. We are unconscious in our sin. So when we wake up, how are we going to respond to this external agent who saves us without any good reason for saving us? How are we going to respond to that or to him? I'll give you a couple of pointers. I think you need to find out who this person is. I think you need to ask the innkeeper to describe him to you. What did he look like? What did he do? What was his characteristics? You need to go get a Yellow Pages and find out. You need to go on Facebook and do something to find out who this person is. And when you found him, you need to ask him a couple of questions. You need to get to know this person. And you need to learn from this person. You need to listen from this person. That is the right response. That is the correct response. And that is the invitation that we have tonight as well. If you accept that you are a bruised, mugged, poor, naked, half-dead person, and I know that's offensive to a lot of people, but that's the Christian view at least, and history supports that notion. Tomorrow's newspapers supports that idea, that is the human condition. If you agree to that, then you must also see this picture of this good Samaritan with a capital G and a capital S coming in and saving us. Not the law, not any of our own efforts, but just this person. And it's just grace. He's had no reason to do that. How are we going to respond to that? Let's close our eyes for a second. And as we are sitting here, let's just try and reflect on that. What does that response look like?
Dear Lord, thank you that we can be here together in your name. Lord, there's a great sacrifice that you ask of us. You ask of us everything, that we love you with all our hearts, with all our minds, with all our strengths and everything we have. But you say also that you provide us with the blessing. You are there for us. You have redeemed us. You are creating new people out of us. From day to day, Lord, may we be the neighbors that we want other people to be for us as well. Might we, yes, be that change that we want to see in the world. Knowing that it will not be easy, knowing that we might not see the good that you make out of it, that sometimes it will cost us maybe an opinion that people have of us that is lower. Maybe it means that we might lose a job. Maybe it might mean that we lose something that is close to us. But thank you that we know that you in the end have paid the ultimate sacrifice and that we've got a safe home with you, that the only eyes that truly matter are yours. May we look at the story and know that that this teaches us how to love others, love you, love ourselves, and how it teaches us how to walk in this world. Amen.
So, please feel free to grab a cup of coffee or a water, and let's talk about this fascinating story of Jesus. So, Derek has the microphone, so if you have anything that you want to say or add or disagree with or ask, you are more than welcome.
Okay, you said at the beginning that most worldviews would agree that love is the answer, so to speak. And I basically agree with that, but I just want to bring in some historical perspectives, just for interest.
Let me just say what I meant with that is that if you a lot of the worldviews, and that's why I don't say all of them, but a lot of them wants to see this neighbor thing work, this relationship. Yeah. So if you think of Marxism, for example, I think they would say that if you buy into this whole idea of the workers class rising, standing strong, the whole concept of Das Kapital or whatever, let's say that's God, then this relationship, the horizontal relationship, will be fine. So that's what I'm saying in terms of how you interpret those things.
Absolutely, but that's actually not. I'm on my way to something.
Okay.
Kind of like the travelers on the road.
Mm.
No, because many atheists and secularists would make the argument that we don't need Jesus' gospel.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we just practice something like Marxism from the beginning?
Mm.
But I just wanted to say, if you look at the pagan worldview, first the Greeks and then the Romans, the idea of really living for your neighbor was more revolutionary than we take it to be. Sure, the Greeks and the Romans practiced kindness upon each other, probably, but there is precious little to really support that. I just want to do something rather strange. Let's say a Roman passed by on the road. I just want to say, speculate what might have happened. It could be that that Roman, if he recognized, if it were another Roman, like a Roman soldier that has fallen, he could have helped him, but for a totally different reason. Both the Greeks and the Romans paid ultimate allegiance to their city.
Mm.
Not even their fellow Greeks or Romans, but they had this abstract idea that's the only thing that's good, was the body of the city.
Yeah.
So in the greater pagan context, this was a truly revolutionary idea that your fellow human being of flesh and blood meant something.
Absolutely. I've got no doubt about it. And that Jesus turned this whole thing on its head is no doubt. I think Hannah Arendt has alluded to that. I think what I try to say is that in the... This Jew who questioned Jesus had the right answer, but he meant two very different things from Jesus, because his idea of his neighbor was Jews, and his idea of God is the God who only loves Jews. You know what I mean? So Jesus responded to that by giving him, in a very subversive way, two variant definitions of God and neighbor. He had a part of the truth, but he didn't have the whole truth. And that's what the story reveals. But you're absolutely right. It was remarkable that there's no doubt that Christians were the first idiots to say, love your neighbor. They were the first guys to say, move out of these groups. They were the first group to say, women are actually cool and they should be part of the group. No, I'm serious. That's why the beginning of the church was full of women and children, because they allowed them in, and women were kind of excited about it and flocked to this new church thing. We're allowed to go. That's pretty cool. And they became leaders in the early church. So the openness of Christianity, the width of God's grace is pretty much what one of the things that differentiates us from these other worldviews. Anything else, Arnold?
Thanks, John. I'm of the view that Jesus basically taught one message, which is kingdom.
Sorry, say that again.
I'm of the view that Jesus preached one basic message and variations on that. This, the message of the kingdom. So with a woman caught in adultery, the law says this, but this is how we but we apply the law mercifully. Loving your neighbor means something very different. I'm the king of this kingdom, and this is how my law or my grace is applied.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't add to that. That's wisdomous.
Thanks, Johan. That was a cool message, and I actually... I'm very intelligent. I know everything. Mm-hmm. But there was actually stuff in this sermon, that I didn't know. For example, that Jesus purposely made the guy naked because, you know, so that they couldn't identify him. I just always thought it's bad to be naked. You know, and that's the point. When you get robbed, it's bad. You don't, you're naked. So, it was a cool message for me. And just like in some of his other parables, you wonder what was the reaction, what was the final... Looking at the text, it looks like that the guy was just was disappointed by Jesus' answer. But you wonder what was the long-term effect on that specific guy. You know, it's almost like that the rich young man who asked Jesus a question as well. So you wonder what happened along the line, because it's quite a harsh teaching that Jesus has. And you wonder... For us sitting 2,000 years later, this means a lot. But for that guy on that moment asking that question, one wonders, you know, if he did along the line change him or in that moment. Or was it kind of like this message wasn't really for that guy, it was for the guys coming after him kind of thing?
So we kind of know how it ended, for Jesus at least. He got killed because he was constantly doing this. He was constantly pushing the boundaries, giving them the full revelation of God and telling them that they've got half-truths, all right? So we know how it ended on that side. But I can't help but think that your frustration is a very a very modern Christian frustration. And what I mean by that is, if you look at Christian stories, Christian movies that we do in popular culture, they always give us. They tell us exactly what happened. There's pretty much always, and they lived happily ever after. And it's interesting how open Jesus' stories ended. There's no way of knowing that the Samaritan story ended well. As a matter of fact, it's reasonable to say it didn't end well for him. So I think we need to, in our storytelling, be and listen. I think I know where you're getting at. It's got to do with compassion. What about this? Where did this guy go? But in response to that, it's very difficult when somebody challenges the two most fundamental views of your life, who's God and who's your neighbor, because that's what Jesus did. And we always, not always, but most often we react aggressively when somebody challenges that. That's why evangelism is such a touchy place. Because if you come and you preach the gospel of Jesus, you are trying to substitute his version of who's God and his version of who's his neighbor. And that's always going to be challenging. But I've also noticed that people walk away from these first engagements annoyed. And then something else happens. And they start wrestling with this issue. And my God is not just the Jesus who told that parable. He's also the Jesus behind the movement of the whole early church, who could have worked in thousands of places and it's not written down. And I'm okay with that, because the God I serve, I kind of trust him. with these things. Michelle.
Okay. thanks, Jan. I want to try and give a question that I've been chewing on a while.
Okay.
I'm going to try and articulate it so that you can understand. It has somewhat to do with the whole neighborly thing, also tying into what Jesus usually says about, you know, loving your enemy and everything. Concerning, like, pantheistic worldview that you explained, that, you know, you am I and I are one and everything is one, and if I look at that worldview, then, like you mentioned, it seems that it correlates well with the worldview. We just define, like, people differently, and we define terms differently. But even in that, I don't really see how, if you're in a conversation with someone that has a pantheistic worldview, how you can actually move towards the place where you disagree on this topic, because how are you going to disagree with them? Like, I don't know if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And also with the whole, I mean, where Jesus says loving your enemy, I remember when you spoke about that once, you said that it was such a revolutionary statement. But coming from an Eastern worldview or a pantheistic worldview, if you take like Buddhism and all that stuff into consideration, I mean, was it really that revolutionary? Because when we talked about that, we focused a lot on like Roman and Greek culture and philosophers of that time talking about that. And they said, yeah, no, don't love your enemy and stuff. But we didn't really look at the other worldview. So for them, it wasn't really that revolutionary what Jesus said. Even though their understanding differs from us, it didn't sound revolutionary to them. So how, I don't know, was Jesus' message really that unique for them?
That's an amazing question.
I'm glad you understand, because
Well, let's see if I understand it. Maybe it's just an amazing question in my head. So what I said about the arguing with a pantheist or somebody who's very much in this Eastern mysticism, and lately you've got a lot of that combined with Christianity, and it's very, very tricky. Because every word that comes out of your mouth, you need to explain. So when I say I mean a separate thing as you. When I say I am, I mean I'm in an ontological... Okay, when I say ontological, I mean... So it becomes very tricky. So I feel that frustration, and I don't have a lot of experience with it. As a matter of fact, last night I had a little bit of an experience with it, and it wasn't a very good experience. I don't think I left there having made the other person anything the wiser. So that's difficult. I tried to take him back to just a philosophical foothold to say, all right, when we talk, we are going to try and talk about meaning ultimately. So where are we going to find that? But that also ended disastrously. So I'm not a very good person to ask about that at the moment. That's the one side. The other one is, if pantheism or panentheism, this whole view that God is in everything and everything is in God, that we're all connected, a popular expression of that would be something like Avatar, the blue world, where there's something of the nature and you need to be in tune with it and you breathe together. And I don't want to do an oversimplification of it, but I suppose that's some of the ideas that it professes. Then obviously in that view, loving your enemy would be natural because it's all part of the oneness. So that's a very good question. And I don't have a very good answer for you. I'll have to come back to you. One of the things that I think still stands is the one that in Jesus' Greco-Roman world, it was absolutely revolutionary, and it changed the world to such an extent that when the gospel went to the East, to places like India, it came in contact with a caste system. I'm not sure if it's the caste system, which does not have any compassion at all, where certain people are born into poverty and that is their divine lot. and you just leave that person, and to help that person would actually be to mess with faith and whatever. And forgive me if I'm doing an oversimplification of that. Adam wants to dive into that. But what I think I would say is that I think just in terms of the terms philosophically, I think it's a very valid question. My reading of the history of the church and this world, it seems as if the church definitely encountered some very evil stuff, even within this philosophy that they addressed. And Herman is going to finish my argument for me.
I'm not an expert in Hinduism or Buddhism, but from what I've heard other people say about this, I don't think it's very difficult to agree that we shouldn't be horrible human beings. Most people would say that. Most religions kind of start there. But also, as I understand it, the Hindu, the good Hindu would respond that guy might be living out his karma, and you don't mess with karma, right? Mm. So he's living out his karma, leave him. And on the Buddhist side, Buddhists are nice people, and they and I'm not saying they don't do good things, but I've kind of read up a bit on the compassion thing, Buddhist compassion, because it's not the same thing when a Buddhist, the Buddhist strives for compassion. He's not striving for the same thing the Christian is striving for when he strives for compassion. The Buddhist compassion is detached. It's you don't get personally involved. You don't get your feelings involved. You don't care. It's like compassion without caring in a Western sense. So, whereas
it's almost denying the reality of evil.
Yes, it denies. It also does that. But I mean, they kind of, I think that they help people. But the distinction I remember somewhere, it might have been Ramzan or someone making, was that the Christian word means that your innards turn, that you feel it in your gut when you see that person, whereas Buddhist compassion is completely detached from your feelings. You might help that person, but you don't care for them the same way Christians do. Hmm. I'm not an expert, but that's kind of what yeah. how I understand.
I think it's an amazing question, and we need to explore it some more. So, thanks, Michelle.
Jan, can I ask a question?
You were missing me.
So, one of the interesting things is if you go to Israel today, the situation hasn't changed, which is interesting. It can now be the good Palestine. And Israelites,
Palestinian.
They don't think something like that exists. What is interesting from the Levite and priest is that Ramzan tells a story about a group of Chinese ministers and people working in the ministry going to America, wanting to find out how these cell groups work and how that builds the church. And after 6 months touring America, someone asked them, so what is your oppression? And they say, it's amazing how much you can do in America without God, which was just interesting. And how these
It's amazing what you can do.
It's amazing how much you guys can do without God.
Oh, wow.
And what the priests do there, they're busy with the work of God, but they miss it entirely. Mm-hmm. So my question then would be: is we go out now today and we drive past a lot of people who are really needy. We drive past people who sleep in the spruit. As you go to mainland from here, in one way, I can't keep on giving. I would have nothing left afterwards. Although I also know that nothing I have is really mine. It's all grace and all given to me. How do I work in a country such as South Africa where there is so much need? How am I the good Samaritan or the, I don't know, just good man? Some people call it, or I don't know. The good Afrikaner. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, that's an oxymoron, eh? I knew that question was going to come. I didn't know it was going to be this late. So that kind of sucks if you are convicted by a sermon. I need to be a neighbor to anybody, and you go out and there is, in the 500 meters it takes you to get home, 6 guys with different stories on their boards telling you to have compassion over them. So I understand the conflict. The the one day I went to a hostel for, it's more like a shelter, for a bunch of boys that stay in the west of Pretoria, where they help kids from the street, and there's a rehabilitation, and they do schooling, and it's an amazing initiative, and very wide. And there's one guy who works at the shelter, this very humble black guy, I forget his name, and I asked him, listen, you're in this game, what must I do with these kids or these people begging? Should I give them money? And he said, I know it's biblical. So this is a Christian organization. He says, I know it's biblical to give them something, but it doesn't help. Now that's quite controversial, I would think. I know it's biblical to give them some money, but I can promise you it doesn't help. Now to give some context to that, I think the one thing that we need to realize is that we've come a long way in terms of our social consciousness, in terms of how society works. There's a lot of shelters, there's a lot of institutions, there's a lot of places that helps people. And it is primarily because of stories like the Good Samaritan. That is why you have the Good Samaritan shelter and the Good Samaritan social welfare. That's why we have a bunch of social workers in this church. And this is a profession that did not exist back then. So that's one thing that we need to realize, that these are people that has gone through a system that has been created by people who was convicted by Jesus' teaching about compassion. So it puts it in a little bit of a different space. Does that make any sense to you guys? To the three of you that nodded. I'm trying to say that this story and Jesus' teachings happened in a system where there was no social welfare. There was no responsibility to anybody. There was no tithing. There was no government grants. There were no shelters, social workers, schools for that matter. And that's something we have now. So when people slip through that, it's a little bit of a different game. And I think one of the things that happens there is that one of the reasons that they might be here is because of character and the people that they are. That doesn't mean that we need to forget about them, but it's one thing that you cannot just apply this whole thing to this. That's one thing I want to say, but I don't think it excuses us from doing something. I think you can help somebody, but I can almost guarantee you that it's going to take a lot more than giving that person R5 or something. This community did it with a kid with a bunch of plastic bottles on his back. Lorraine took him in, and we had him for about 11 months, where we clothed him, sent him to school, gave him accommodation, food and everything. And in that process, we realized that there's a whole bunch of character problems that came through as well. And the whole story ended very sadly, with Brian walking out and etc. So it's problematic, but I think it's gonna look something like that, Derek, where it's not just money, but it is your time. It is allowing this person in your space, because I think today our problem is not so much. Then it was more economical, or giving that person a little bit of these resources. Today, that's a big problem, but it's fundamentally a character problem, because we saw what happened when we gave somebody the resources, but their character led them away from that, and they ended up at the same place where we got him from. So I think it's more complex, but what I'm trying to say with this massive third sermon of the night is that I think we need to be more strategic in how we do this. And that means that if you have a relationship with that person, with that beggar, then spend time with that person. See if you can work on his or her character. See if you can invest in that person. But we know now, it has been proven in maatschappelijke wetenschappen, that you are not helping this person. I know Helping the Hand, the Solidariteit guys that helped the poor white people, they told us that that if you give money to a white person on the street, you are definitely funding their drug addiction. It is not even a question. They brought out a statement that it's 95% sure that the white beggars on the street are drug addicts. The black people are a little bit better than the whites in terms of their drug addiction. So that statistic definitely varies. So that is complex, and it needs... There needs to be a rehabilitation something. And that's why a couple of years ago, in my complex where I stay, I heard the shouting. I saw police people trying to come in, and it looked exciting. I was supposed to work on a sermon, so I went outside and saw what was happening. And I opened the gate for the police, and they came in, and I figured out, you know, that those very nosy people who just stand and try to figure out what's going on and then, you know, gossip a little bit. I was that person. And I figured out that one of the houses in our complex is owned by an old lady. She's a pensioner. And for the last 3 or 4 years, she's been taking drug addicts off the street and having them stay there and rehabilitate them. And I always saw these dodgy-looking people walking in and out of the gate, and I just thought, okay, well, maybe I'm not living in the middle class as I thought I was. So it was kind of weird for me a couple of times. And she had a tremendous success rate. Very charismatic. So I think she prayed every drug demon out of those kids. And when this one kid wanted, I'm saying kids, they were kind of adults. When this one guy wanted money or wanted drugs, she said no. And he started to attack her, and she just phoned the police. And she was very blasé. No, sometimes they attack me. I just phoned the police, and this happens. But that's an answer, I think, to this thing. It's going to be a lot more all-encompassing. It's going to be a lot more expansive than just this once-off thing. I know it doesn't help, and I don't want to give you guys a freebie for walking away and saying, remember, we've thought about it. I'm not helping this person because it's not helping him. That's not good enough. We've got Tim Bisa's stuff, and remember what Yaku said. It's about works. Christianity is about works. So there's a lot of ways to be part of addressing this. To be a good Afrikaner, or a good Samaritan, or a good whatever. All right. I'm going to end on that note to all of your relief. Friends...